It is an honor here to be presenting Harav Daniel Feldman. Rav Feldman is a Magid Shir in the Stone Beit Midrash program, and he's the director of rabbinic research at the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. He's the author of The Right and Good, Halacha and Human Relations, and three books in Hebrew titled Bina Basfarim. He's the co-editor of six volumes of Talmudic essays, and he has smicha from Yeshiva University, Yora Yora Yadin Yadin, and he's a graduate of the Wexner Kollel program. So without further ado, Harav Feldman.
Thank you so much. Do you prefer standing, sitting? Okay, we're going to try standing, see if that works. I just came from the session about blogs, and you know that one of the major questions that came up there were various pitfalls and various dangers of the quote-unquote blogosphere is, of course, the risk of embarrassing people. It sounds like I'm on several microphones. Does that sound right? I'm hearing myself a couple times. Okay. So the issue, one of the major issues that's raised is, of course, the question of embarrassing people in public, which is a matter which is treated very severely in halacha. And what I'd like to do this morning is just take a little bit of a survey, go a little bit through some of the discussions that have taken place in the halachic literature concerning this issue. And as we'll discuss, not all of these discussions are necessarily normative or necessarily definitive. Much of what's suggested and much of what's discussed is not actually practical, but it does teach us a lot about the attitude that the halachic thinkers had towards this issue. And I think it's very important for us to be able to keep this in mind when we go through our day-to-day challenges, our daily issues where embarrassing others seems to be a temptation, it seems to be a situation that we're placed in, and when we're cognizant and we're sensitive to the types of discussions that can be found in the halachic literature, I think it has a lot to do with how we relate to the issue. So I'd like, with your permission, to look a little bit at some of the discussions that we found in the halachic sphere and perhaps put it in somewhat of a framework and see what does that tell us about the sensitivity to this issue that we should be having. So to begin with, the Talmud has a discussion in Maseches Bava Metzia. The Talmud tells us a story involving King David. King David, without going into the details, had a scandal in his past. We're familiar with the stories in the Nevi'im, the episode with Bathsheba. And whatever it is, without going into all the details, he was trying to get past it. And as we know, in a modern context, you have a politician who's trying to put a scandal behind him. It doesn't go so easily. The press doesn't leave you alone. And they're always looking to restart things. And the Talmud tells us that this was a problem that King David had as well. That he would give a lecture on a Torah topic. He would talk about the laws of Shabbos, the laws of Kashrus, whatever, something completely unrelated. And he'd be giving a lecture. And in the middle of the lecture, somebody would raise his hand in the back and say, "Hi, King, I have a question about that point you just made about the laws of Shabbos. Yeah, tell me, what's the rule for somebody who gets involved with a married woman?" So clearly it didn't have anything to do with the shir. This was an attempt to embarrass him. This wasn't anything in the vein of a serious question. This was an attempt to humiliate him in public, which he, of course, realized. And the king responded, "Well, that's a good question. Somebody who commits adultery does get executed in theory under the right circumstances, but at least after that, he has a portion of the next world. However, somebody who embarrasses people in public has no portion in the world to come." And his intent seemed to be clear, as the Talmud clarifies, that perhaps it's even worse for a person to embarrass someone in public than to be involved with a possibly married woman. That's formulated as a statement in the Talmud, preferable for a person to be involved with a possibly married woman rather than embarrass someone in public. And it appears there, you don't find it so much in the halachic source. The halachic sources don't really record that statement, probably because it's not the kind of issue that comes up every day. Most of us are not really deciding between these two choices, and it's not the kind of thing that the practical codes will really put inside their texts. However, the Gemara goes on from that point to give another case which actually is more of a topic of discussion. And the Talmud talks about the story, which we're going to read about in Sefer Bereishis pretty soon, about the story of Yehuda and Tamar, another story in which I'm not going to get into too many of the details, but just the important point is that Tamar was on trial for adultery. She was on trial for the accusation that she was made pregnant by someone other than who it was, other than Yehuda. She was supposed to marry someone in the family because of the laws of Yibam. Her husband had died without children, and she was supposed to marry somebody within Yehuda's family. And she was actually impregnated by Yehuda himself, and he didn't realize that. He didn't know who she was. So she was on trial because of the presumption of adultery. And she could have exonerated herself. She could have cleared her name by saying in open court that the father was Yehuda. But if we read the text in Bereishis, we see that's not the way she chose to operate. And rather, she made it possible for him to identify himself. She had taken certain evidence that it was him. And she said whoever this evidence is relevant to should come forward. And Yehuda chose on his own to come forward. And the implication you get is that had Yehuda not come forward, she wouldn't have done anything. Had he not said, I was the one, she would have let things proceed. She would have allowed herself to be executed rather than embarrass him against his will. And that's a shocking decision on so many levels, and we can't fully explain it because the commentaries have a very hard time with it. Because even if we were to take such an extreme stance, this idea that one should give up their life rather than embarrass someone in public, that itself is an extreme stance, and we'll talk about that in a second. But it's very hard to believe that in a courtroom setting, you wouldn't be entitled to defend yourself by saying what the facts really are. And that's a topic that the commentaries debate, and they don't really have a good resolution for. And so no one's actually asserting that in a setting of a courtroom, that you don't have the right to defend yourself. That's beyond what anyone would assert, and therefore that's a problem just on the interpretation of the text, what exactly is going on there. That's a textual difficulty that we're not really going to address right now. But the abstract idea that she was willing to risk her life rather than embarrass someone in public, so that is an abstract notion. So that the Gemara does state as a sentence, but apparently Noach lo yadam, it's preferable for a person sheyapil atzmo lekivshan shalesh. It's preferable for a person to let himself get thrown into a fiery furnace rather than embarrass someone in the public. A very extreme statement, and it's not the only place in rabbinic writings that you find that. We find the Midrashim say this as well, again in Sefer Bereishis towards the end, when Yosef meets up with his brothers. You know, that Yosef was sold into slavery by his brothers, and things worked out well for him because he became vice president of Egypt. And eventually the brothers met up with him, didn't at first know who he was. And then eventually he revealed himself to them. And the Torah tells us that when he revealed himself to the brothers, he first made sure that all his bodyguards left the room. He didn't want to embarrass them by having anybody outside of the family present when this meeting took place. So therefore he cleared the room. He asked everyone who wasn't part of the family to leave. So this was a risky move, because if he cleared the room of his bodyguards, so then there was the possibility that these brothers would say, well, we're kind of in trouble now, because it turns out this person who's the vice president of Egypt is the same guy who we sold into slavery. But at least we're alone with him, we can take care of him, and we can run away, and no one's going to stop us. So he basically put his life at risk in making this decision. And it's a debate in the Medrash whether this was a good thing or not. Was this a smart move? Was this what has to be, because the sensitivity towards embarrassing others requires even putting your life at risk? Or was this really the wrong thing to do, and that's an opinion in the Medrash as well? So this thing again is a shocking concept. This idea that one would put their life at risk rather than embarrass someone in public is a very shocking idea. And it's not an idea that we're necessarily endorsing practically speaking. Again, as we indicated at the beginning, I would really emphasize from the very top, do not try this at home. But it is a topic of some discussion. This idea that there is what we would call a yehoreg ve'al yavor status. We know there are very few things in halacha which one is required to give up his life rather than violate, such as idolatry and murder. Small handful of things that one is required yehoreg ve'yavor, be killed rather than violate. And we weren't aware until now that this is part of the list. We weren't aware that this is another item that we should add to this group of transgressions that are so crucial. If one violates them, one has to give up his life rather than violate them. So do we take this literally? It was a debate among poskim, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Again, constantly emphasizing, do not try this at home. But it seems that the central issue would seem to be what the Talmud goes on to say over there in Bava Metzia, that there is some comparison between humiliation and death. The Talmud suggests that somebody who humiliates someone else is as if he spilled blood. On the surface, the Talmud gives a physiological clue that the person's blood drains, that's literally spilling blood, but that doesn't really seem to be the core of the issue. Really, the core of the issue apparently is that the suffering a person goes through when they are genuinely humiliated apparently is so profound and is so deeply painful that that could be considered on a level like death. And we may or may not be able to relate to this. This is something that's very individual in nature. But we do know that it is a fact that there are people throughout history, even recent history, who have chosen death rather than humiliation when faced with something about to be revealed, when faced with some type of scandal that's about to break. People have chosen suicide over humiliation. So whether or not it's a decision that we personally would make is a different question. Whether or not it's something that we as individuals relate to, you could ask. But certainly the phenomenon exists. The idea that there is a level of humiliation to which someone would prefer death, that is not a completely foreign idea in history, both older history and more recent history. So that seems to be the core of the issue. When the Talmud says that embarrassing somebody is like killing them, so is that meant to be read literally? That whatever halachic regulations would be addressed towards murder would be addressed here as well, for all intents and purposes? Or are we to say this is really a homiletic reference? This is really just a way of making our point. It's a way of conveying the message that this is something very severe. But practically speaking, the ramifications of murder, we wouldn't be ready to put into practice. And to begin with, this opening question seems to be very much the issue. We know that Yeharig Valyavor, allow yourself to be killed rather than violate the halacha, is the rule when it comes to murder. The Talmud tells us that if somebody says, here's a gun, shoot that innocent person, or I'll shoot you. So the halacha is, we're not allowed to kill an innocent person to save our own life, and we have to allow this person to shoot us. So the Talmud says, who says that his blood is not as red as yours? Maybe who says that your life is more worth saving than that person's life? You don't have the right to say, well, I'm so important, I'll kill him to save me. So therefore we have this rule, Yeharig v'al-Yavor, that we're not allowed to kill even to save a life. So if one takes really the comparison literally, and one says that embarrassing people is really comparable to killing, for all intents and purposes, so then one could come to this conclusion that the Talmud states, that maybe it's preferable for a person to allow himself to be killed rather than embarrass someone in public. And there were apparently Rishonim who actually did endorse this, practically speaking. Again, this is an earlier stage of Zvalt Halacha. If you have a flashing sign in the back, don't try this at home. But most prominent among these was Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah, actually most prominent, most explicit, really, among these. Rabbeinu Yonah was one of the great Rishonim, the author of the classic Musar work, Shari Tshuva. And Rabbeinu Yonah writes in his work that he really sees this as literal, that this is something that you have to go to all lengths to avoid humiliating someone in public. It could be that this is also the opinion of Tosfos on the side of the page of the Talmud, the commentary on the side of the page, which raises the question that we're normally told that there are really only three prohibitions that you're supposed to give up your life for: murder, idolatry, and sexual immorality. So if that's true, so where does this one come from? This is not part of the list. So that's the question Tosfos raises. And the answer Tosfos gives is not, well, because it's not really literal. If that were the answer, that would reveal their position that they're not really taking it literally. Apparently, since the fact Tosfos actually gives a different answer to that question, shows that Tosfos does consider it to be a real question. It does think it's really, practically speaking, on the issue. That's the way the Brisker Rav, Rav Elbel Soloveitchik, understood this Tosfos. There's a lot of debate circling with Tosfos how exactly to read it, but many later works understood it that way, that Tosfos is clearly saying that it's not a joke, it's not literal, it's not something that we should dismiss. It's just that question, why is it not included in the other lists? That's something, a technical issue that has to be addressed. So on the one hand, you have these Rishonim that seem to take this view, that it may actually be literal. On the other hand, you have a group of Rishonim that don't see it that way. And most explicit in that camp is to Meiri. Meiri is a later Rishon, and Meiri writes clearly, he's the one who writes this most explicitly, that this expression is a derech ha'ara, derech tzachos. It's meant homiletically. It's meant to make a point. It's not meant to be taken literally, and it's a way of conveying the severity of what's involved, but it doesn't mean literally that that's actually the case. Hi. That's a good question. That we'll address a little bit later on, because clearly it's a quite a range, and we'll get to that hopefully in a few minutes in some basic sense. So also probably in this camp, and it's also a subject to interpretation, is the Rambam. The Rambam Maimonides, in his code, he's quite explicit that there are certain things you have to give up your life for, and everything else you may not give up your life for. And he doesn't write embarrassing people in public as one of the things you give up your life for. And since the way he writes is very clear, you're either in one camp or the other, it's either you must or you may not, so it's generally taken by many of the commentaries, not all, but by many of the later commentaries, that the Rambam is really with a Meiri in this, and the Rambam didn't take this literally either. The Rambam didn't feel this was something that you give up your life for. So this was a debate, apparently, among the Rishonim, and it was a debate in later generations as well. And it's really a debate that the modern posts were also writing essays about. Again, it's a topic that affects your life, and it's a question of suffix, it's a question of somewhat unresolved analytical nature. So again, I would emphasize, don't try it at home. And one of the explanations that might be valuable to why we wouldn't try it practically, I saw once an article was written by Rabbi Pinchas Levinson, and it really addresses Mo's question a little bit, that the way he presented it is that, yes, it's true that in theory there is a level of humiliation that is equal to death. And again, we've seen that in the real world, that people have chosen death over a certain degree of humiliation. But, as we also know, with common sense, obviously that's not true about every aspect of humiliation. If I would spill some soda on my pants right now, I'd be a little embarrassed, but I don't think anybody would say I would give up my life rather than go through that. There's embarrassment and there's embarrassment. Clearly, there is a range. There are things that are embarrassing and I'd rather not happen, and there are things that are a devastating embarrassment and never go away. And then there are things that we think are going to be very bad and blow over. And a week later, nobody remembers. So clearly, there is quite a range here. So what Rabbi Levinson suggested, and it's very possible this is really the key to the issue, is that the Talmud is saying that, yes, it's true, there are times when humiliation could be so great that it's going to be even worse than death for some people. But you never know going in that that's the situation that we're dealing with. You never know that that's what we're going to be talking about. It's so many variables. So to say something drastic, like you're actually going to give up your life rather to avoid this, so practically speaking, we'll never say that because it's too variable. We never know beforehand that we're talking about a scenario that's going to require you to give up your life. But again, and this is going to really be the constant refrain throughout, when we're not talking about a life-threatening situation, when we consider the fact that we're talking about something which there are posts and we say give up your life rather than do this, or where there's a scenario where if it gets severe enough, it would actually be so then the message is clear that when we're talking about more mundane challenges where it's not a risk to our lives, where it's not something like that, so then the concern of avoiding embarrassing others clearly is a very, very major one when the price to pay is anything less than what these poskim are talking about. So that would be really step one in that discussion, that if we consider this question, is this comparison literal? So one question that comes to mind right away is, how do you read the statement in the Talmud when the Talmud seems to suggest that one should give up his life rather than embarrass people? Is that sentence literal, or is that really more of a homiletic sentence? That would really seem to go around this question. Is this a real comparison, or is it a way of conveying severity in a more homiletic sense? And this is something that Poskim really discussed in a number of other scenarios. To give you another example that's not acceptable halacha either, pretty much, there is a radical ruling of a great postdoc named Rav Shlomo Kluger. Rav Shlomo Kluger was a great halachic author, was the Rav of Brod, and he wrote a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, and in the end of his commentary to Choshen Mishpat, he has a ruling which everybody who wrote afterwards disagreed with. There was much writing in later literature to take issue with this ruling of the Rav Shlomo Kluger, and the truth is he actually has a different way of proving it than what we're discussing now. He comes from a different angle, but it's relevant to this point as well. So Rav Shlomo Kluger has a discussion. Now let's say I'm walking past the river, I'm walking past the ocean, and I see somebody drowning. And I know how to swim. I can jump in and save this person. So I'm obligated to do that. The Torah says, Lo samor al dam reyecha. I'm not allowed to just stand by when somebody's life is at risk. I have to jump in and save this person's life. So let's say I'm not such a strong swimmer. And I know, I'm pretty confident, that if I jump in the ocean, I'll probably drown too. Maybe I'll be able to push this person to safety, but I would have to sacrifice my life in order to do it. So then, clearly you're not obligated to do it. You're not even supposed to do it, probably. There's a dispute between the Babylonian Talmud and the Yerushalmi Talmud about whether you're supposed to risk your life to save somebody else's life. But to give it up, that clearly you don't do. So says Rav Shlomo Kluger, what if I could save somebody else's life, but I'd have to humiliate myself in order to do it? So he came to the conclusion, and again, if you look the way he writes it, he has a different proof of this, which we're not getting into because it comes from a different area of halacha. He writes that you're not obligated to save somebody else's life if it means embarrassing yourself. And again, this is a conclusion one could come to if one really views humiliation as actually equal to death. So then one could say, if I'm not obligated to kill myself to save somebody's life, so I'm also not obligated to humiliate myself. But again, this point nobody was willing to accept, and many of the later authors who wrote about this took great issue with this, and it doesn't seem that anyone really agrees with this point, that you're allowed to refrain from saving somebody's life in order to avoid embarrassment. And one of the great names, one of the great recent poskim who took issue with this ruling was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, again, passed away a few years ago, was known as one of the greatest poskim in the world. So he has a lengthy essay in which he makes reference to this Chacham Shlomo, and he says clearly that's not the way we understand it. And we know there is a certain line. We wouldn't view somebody who's coming to humiliate you as a rodef. You wouldn't say that you could shoot somebody if he's coming to humiliate you. There is a difference at one point when we're weighing, on the one hand, actual physical death and humiliation. So he's not ready to accept that question, nor is he ready to accept Rav Shlomo Kluger's question. But you see from his writing that he does, to a certain degree, accept a literal comparison. Because what he's troubled about in that essay, and this is a question that he really found very difficult, and this is one of the greatest poskim of modern times, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, he's not sure why it is that we don't violate the Shabbos in order to prevent somebody from being humiliated. That the rule is, if somebody's life is at risk on Shabbos, we're going to violate Shabbos in order to save their life. So why shouldn't we say the same thing, that if somebody's at risk of humiliation, and I could do something to save their life, I could do something to save them from humiliation, so why shouldn't I do that, even if it means violating Shabbos? And he's not sure what the answer is, because he knows that that's not the practice. Now, if it's a matter of rabbinical law, so then it could be that we would violate rabbinical law, because the Talmud does say, and this is a whole separate discussion in and of itself, that for the purposes of human dignity, we sometimes do violate rabbinical law, and that's a whole other topic. But if it's a matter of biblical law, if it's a biblical violation of Shabbos, he's not ready to say that you should do it, but he's not sure intellectually why not. He's not sure analytically why that should be. It seems like there are grounds to make such a conclusion. I think... Right, so the question of how exactly do you understand the reason for violating the Shabbos, there are different drushes in the Gemara about that, so that's one of them. So without getting into all the detail of that, could take us a little bit far afield, that could be one approach, and I apologize for not explaining it in the interest of time. But I think probably the most direct answer is really similar to what Rav Pinchas Levinson, I quoted earlier about the topic of giving up your life. I think that answer is very much relevant here as well. That humiliation, again, is such a range, that there's such a spectrum of what could happen, that as severe as it is, to take drastic measures to prevent it, we're a little hesitant to do because we don't know how it's going to play out. So to give up your life in order to avoid embarrassing somebody is a drastic measure for something that we don't really know how it's going to play out. And to be Mechal Shabbos, that's a drastic measure. So maybe in theory there are cases where Rav Shlomo Zalman himself maybe would be qualified to say on a case-by-case basis, this is a case I would violate Shabbos for. But to say, as a matter of codified halacha, that we would allow it to any humiliation, so that's something that would very easily lead itself to abuse, really, in probably the vast majority of cases, because the range is so broad that this is something that's very hard for us to apply practically. So it could be, again, as Rav Shlomo Zalman is perhaps indicating, in theory there is truth to it, but in practice it's not something that we're really able to put into practice. And there are other issues that the halachic authorities take up as far as, again, how do we take this comparison? How literally do we take this comparison? For example, we know we have a practice, in Israel we do this every day, and outside of Israel we don't do it every day, we only do it on Yontif. We have a practice called Birchas Kohanim, and on Yontif the Kohanim get up in front of the shul, and they bless the congregation. So the Talmud says that not all Kohanim are eligible for this job. Some Kohanim are not a proper fit. And the Talmud says, for example, in the end of Maseches Brachos, if you have a Kohen who has killed somebody, so this is inconsistent with Birchas Kohanim. Birchas Kohanim is a blessing of peace. And if you have a Kohen who has killed somebody, so he's not really a proper match for Birchas Kohanim. Talmud quotes a verse in the book of Isaiah, my hands are filled with blood, and such hands should be used as a siyas kapayim, the hands are part of the Birchas Kohanim. The Talmud says that's inappropriate.
Does that refer to self-defense?
So that's a big debate in Poskim. And there is logic on both sides. The big debate is whether this means murder, or does it mean perhaps even justifiable self-defense or in war, or what about in between, somebody who's negligent, let's say somebody who killed somebody with their car, is discussion in Poskim. So there's logic on both sides. There are those who understand it. The strong view in Poskim say this is only talking about murder. It's not talking about self-defense or in the army or the like. And there are others who would say that look at David HaMelech. David HaMelech was a man of war for the right reasons, and still God told him that he wasn't appropriate to build a Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash had to be built by somebody who was a man purely of peace, including war for the right reasons. So one could hear that if this bracha is just a bracha of peace, that even if somebody killed for justifiable reasons, he may still be not a good mix. That's a topic that really is a different topic, and so we won't get into that right now. But in theory, so the Talmud tells us that a Kohen who's killed somebody shouldn't be involved in Birchas Kohanim. So some poskim discuss that two of the great poskim of contemporary times, two great living poskim, on the one hand, Rav Nassim Gishtetner, who's a great posek in Bnei Brak, and Rav Vosner, the author of the Tshuva Shevet Halevi, both discuss the question, if you have a Kohen who goes around embarrassing people in public, maybe he shouldn't be duchening either. Maybe he shouldn't be involved in Birchas Kohanim. Maybe we should see that as equivalent to murder. So they discuss this topic in that essay. And both of these two great poskim do not come to this conclusion. They're not really ready to buy into the whole literal comparison. They don't see this as actual murder. Rav Gishtetner actually writes that even if you were to say that it is equivalent to murder, but the Talmud quotes this verse in Isaiah, my hands are filled with blood, it must be a reference to physical murder. And some non-physical act that is equivalent to murder, even if it was actually equivalent, wouldn't still make the cut. And that was the way he looked at it. So these two poskim did not come to the conclusion that they were ready to see this as actually literal. But it's interesting, if you look in some of the books that have been printed recently about the laws of Birchas Kohanim, some of them do take a stricter stance on this and do write that if you have a Kohen who goes around humiliating people, he may not be appropriate for Birchas Kohanim. So that's another question that really goes to this point. To what extent are we ready to see this comparison as literal? It's really actually considered like an act of murder. Or is it something that we use as a homiletic point, but we're not actually ready to say that it should be a prohibition in that level? Hi.
How do you avoid embarrassing that
coin? I know, that's a frequent question people are interested in. So maybe that's an embarrassment to that coin. So ideally, hopefully, you'll deal with it in advance. And you'll tell this coin, listen, it's Birchas Kohanim in a few minutes, maybe you want to go to the bathroom, or maybe you want to take a walk outside. Hopefully you're not going to embarrass him at the same time. There are other reasons why people don't duchen at times. If you're too slow, you don't wash in time, you're also not going to make it up there. So in theory, if he's going to cooperate, there are times that you could do it. But if he's not going to cooperate, you're going to have trouble anyway, probably. But in theory, it seems like an interesting challenge, but there are ways to do it. Another question that poskim talk about is also relevant to this issue, is the question of, do we view this prohibition of embarrassing people, do we see it as something that's applicable to all of humanity? Now what I mean by that is not that the question of who you're allowed to embarrass, the question of who does this prohibition address. Do we assume that this is a mitzvah for Jews, Jews are not allowed to embarrass people, or do we say that all of humanity is subject to this prohibition, no one is allowed to embarrass anyone? And that also goes to this question, because we know that we don't assume that the whole world is bound by 613 mitzvahs. We don't assume that the whole world is supposed to keep Shabbos and is supposed to avoid eating non-kosher food. We assume that for most of humanity, there are seven guiding principles. We call the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, the seven Noahide commandments. And one of them is don't kill, don't murder. So if we would include humiliation within murder, so then we would say this is something all of humanity has as a prohibition. While if we view it simply as a separate prohibition, not really included in murder, so then it would seem like it doesn't make the list. It would seem like it's not one of these big seven. So that was also a debate in Poskim. The Chuvah Shvas Yaakov has a discussion about this. And again, it goes to this question of how literal do you take things? Is this really equal to murder, or is that a shnahamaletic point? And that question brings us to a question that's a little more philosophical in nature and really gets us to the second stage of our discussion. That we started off with a statement of David HaMelech, that King David said that somebody who embarrasses somebody in public is worse than an adulterer because he has no portion in the world to come. So where do we get that from? Where did he get that idea from? Okay, it's a mishnah in Pirkei Avos as well, but that didn't have a Pirkei Avos. So where does Chazal get this idea from that somebody who embarrasses somebody in public is not worthy, is not deserving of a portion of the world to come? That's a very severe punishment. That's something that's quite sweeping to say you don't have a portion in the next world. That's a very major idea. And where does it come from that somebody who humiliates people in public is in this category? And this is a topic that there were many theories about, many theories in the earlier Svarim, many theories in the later Svarim. And two of those who had theories about this topic were the Rambam, Maimonides, and Rabbeinu Yonah. And it could be suggested that their respective opinions here are actually consistent with the views, we mentioned them earlier in our discussion, and their views in the earlier point are consistent with their views here. So we call in the Beis Medrash, we call this a l'shitaso, that when you see that there's two statements of the same author and they work out with each other, they're consistent, so we're able to understand the one in light of the other, that's what we call l'shitaso. It works out, it's consistent, he's consistent with his own opinion. So in this topic, it seems that the Rambam and Rabbeinu Yonah are both l'shitasam, because we mentioned at the beginning of our discussion about the question of whether one would give up their life rather than embarrass someone. So we mentioned that Rabbeinu Yonah said, yes, you should. Apparently the comparison is literal, it's actual death. And the Rambam, more by omission, the Rambam seemed to say, no, you don't. It's not considered to be actual murder. We don't go that far. So those opinions are important in this issue because they seem to be consistent. Because here in explaining why it is there's no portion of the world to come, why such a severe punishment, so they give explanations that match their previous statements. Rabbeinu Yonah, for example, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, so Rabbeinu Yonah writes that the reason that one who embarrasses someone has no portion of the world to come, says Rabbeinu Yonah, because he's a murderer. He's the same thing as a murderer. So he gets the punishment of a murderer. But you'll object to Rabbeinu Yonah, we don't have any source that says a murderer doesn't have a portion of the world to come. So it seems that this guy's actually worse than a murderer. So says Rabbeinu Yonah, you're right, he's worse than a murderer. Why is he worse than a murderer? Because a murderer, he does something that everyone acknowledges as terrible. It's maybe a whole scandal and a trial and he'll go to jail. He'll realize that what he did was terrible. And eventually he'll come to repent. And when he repents, so he'll pay the price in this world, but in the next world he'll have a portion in the world to come. But the guy who embarrasses people, he doesn't think he did anything so terrible. He thinks, this is my style, this is the way I talk, it's just a joke, it doesn't matter. And the fact that it's actually equal to murder, he's never going to pay attention to. So he'll never repent, he's not going to think he did anything too bad. And he's left with a punishment that the murderer would have gotten. And that punishment, says Rabbeinu Yonah, no portion in the world to come. Which is also important for us to understand that this is all presuming no repentance. That everyone still has the ability to repent, there's always the concept of tshuva. But if the individual doesn't do tshuva, so then he's left with a punishment of no portion of the world to come. And so that's what Rabbeinu Yonah is focusing on, that chances are he's not going to repent. He's not going to ever come to realize the severity of what he did. So that's consistent with Rabbeinu Yonah's previous view, that it's equal to murder, so therefore it plays out here as well. So what about the Rambam? When the Rambam said that it's not, or didn't say, rather, that it's not equal to murder, that It's not something he would actually say give up your life for. So how does he explain this? So if you look at the way the Rambam in his commentary to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin writes, you see that he has an explanation that is consistent with this idea. That the way the Rambam explains it, it's not that it's quid pro quo. It's not that you commit this crime, you get that punishment. That somebody who does one act of humiliating somebody in public is going to be punished with, boom, no portion of the world to come. That's not the way he understands it. Rather, the way he explains it is that if you have somebody who regularly embarrasses people in public, who does this normally, who does this often, so then that's an indication that he's in a specific halachic category known as a jerk. And a jerk is probably, you could assume, is probably not a ben olam haba. It's probably not somebody who, if you add up all the parts of his life, is probably not somebody who has merited reward in the next world. So that's the way the Rambam understands it. It's not that, boom, push one button, get this punishment. But that if this is the type of guy we're talking about, it's a person of very low moral character, and it's a safe guess that he's not part of the group that is worthy of eternal reward. So again, that's consistent with the Rambam's view that it's not actually equal to murder. We're not talking about a direct punishment for a direct crime, but rather it's an indication of a personality trait. There is a third explanation that you find in Sfarim, and I think this is also useful for moving us along here in this discussion, that there are those who suggest, you find this in the commentaries to Mishnayos and the Tosfos Yontif quotes this, that really it is what we call midah keneged midah. It is proportional. It is fair to say that somebody who embarrasses people should have no portion in the world to come. It is an appropriate punishment. Why? Because where does this whole idea of a portion of the world to come from? Now, this whole idea that we have an eternal soul that can benefit from such a reward, that will enjoy a world in the non-physical realm, where does that come from? So that comes from a pasuk we read 2 weeks ago, that we're told that we're created, B'Tzelem Elokim, that God created us in His image. And His image means that beyond having a body, we have a soul as well. And therefore, that soul can benefit from having a world to come. However, the idea of Tzelem Elokim is also the source for something else. It's also the source for human dignity. The reason we have to treat people respectfully is because they are created in the image of God. So somebody who would humiliate people, somebody who would say is no importance to human dignity, we don't care about human dignity, is basically saying, I don't believe in the Tzelem Elokim. In fact, the pasuk we read last week in Parshas Noah, so the pasuk says that Shofech Dam Ha'adam Ba'adam Damo Yishofech, that somebody who spills the blood of a person shall have his blood spilled, Kibbutz Tzelem Elokim, something like the pasuk says, because God says, I created human beings in the image of God. So the Alshech is one of many commentaries who picks up on the interesting phrasing of the pasuk, Shofech Dam Ha'adam Ba'adam, somebody who spills the blood of another person in a person. If you read the two words together, it comes out that way. Adam ba'adam, person in a person. So what does that mean, a person in a person? So the Al-Shech writes, this is a reference to humiliation. It means the internal person, the person inside of the person, the emotional person. So you could kill that person by humiliating them. That's an act of murder. And such a person has to be realizing that, Kibbutz Elam Elokim, that this person was created in the image of God, and to humiliate them is a denial of that reality. So that's another strain that we find, that there is an appropriateness to this punishment, because somebody who would take away somebody else's dignity, somebody who would strike at that essence of a person, is basically denying the Tzelem Elokim, is denying the image of God that every human being contains. So that really takes us to another question. That we've been talking this whole time about the prohibition of embarrassing someone in public. And a lot of that sentence needs definition. We've been pushing it off. First of all, the way it's phrased in Hebrew, so the Talmud calls it malbin p'nei chavero berabim, to whiten somebody's face in public. Now, the truth is, every word of that phrase we could ask a question about. First of all, malbin, it's not what we would normally assume. To make somebody's face turn white, normally, we would assume if somebody's embarrassed, their face turns red. They blush. So the truth is, there are some texts, not so commonly found, but there are some emendations that change the text in the Talmud to ma'adin p'nei chaver b'rabim. You redden somebody's face in public, but clearly the vast majority of texts have it as whiten. And here the commentaries explain that when a person gets humiliated medically, so first the blood goes up to the face, they turn red, and then it drains. They turn white, so we call blanching. It all drains. So that's what Talmud's referring to, the end part of the process. Red, then white. So you create a whitening of the face. Okay, fine. So that's the first part. But what about the second part of the phrase? Malbim p'nei chavero berabim. You embarrass someone in public. When we refer to public, is that just a habitual use of the phrase? Or is that really part of what's going on here? Is that a key part of the issue? So basically, there are two questions we could ask. One question is, does it have to be in public in order to be a transgression? What if I embarrass somebody in private? Is that also a problem, or is that permissible? And the second question is, what is public? Does public mean it's got to be on a blog? Public mean it's got to be in the newspaper? It's got to be in front of a minion? It's got to be in front of 100 people? What does public mean? So we'll start with the second question first. What does public mean? So here there seems to be pretty much a consensus among the poskim who deal with this issue that public does not mean a minion, and it doesn't have to be on a blog, that public means three people. That when something is known to three people, this is a concept that's borrowed from the laws of Lashon Hara, that we find in the laws of Lashon Hara, when something is known to three people, it's considered to be public knowledge. And the idea is that your friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a neighbor who has a cousin, who has a barber, who has an uncle, who has a neighbor who knows somebody else. And if three people know, so the whole world knows. So three people is considered to be public knowledge. Hi. So that was my next point. Very good. Thank you. So that's a perfect infomercial. So the next, so that is something the post can point out also, that the three include the embarrassor and the embarrassee. So really it boils down to one person, one witness, one person other than the involved parties, that's considered to be in public. Okay, so fine, but let's say I don't even have that one witness. Let's say it's really just me and somebody else. So does it have to be in public? Is public really a key part of what's going on? Or is that just a way of talking, but really this prohibition applies in private as well? Hi? Please. So they're not really a witness.
So,
right, so we're going to assume three involved people. Three people who know what's going on. Three people who know what's going on. So is that a necessary part of the story, or is that just the way we talk? If there are no witnesses, is it still prohibited? So that you have a little bit less consensus on. There were Rishonim who did feel that really the prohibition is in public, and there were Rishonim who felt that it's not affected by public. In private, it's the same thing. It's not really a question of private or public. And there is an interesting split that you see, and that's the one that's really found in later sources, not found so much in Rishonim, but that's the one that interests me more. I'd like to zero in on that one. That you do find later sources that suggest kind of a compromise. But if you embarrass somebody in private, that's wrong. That's prohibited. And you embarrass somebody in public, that's gefer, that's like murder, and maybe give your life and violate Shabbos and don't dochen and all that stuff. That's if you embarrass somebody in public. If you embarrass somebody in private, it's prohibited. So what does that distinction mean? Where did that distinction come from? So I think in order to address that distinction, so we have to go back to the basics that we haven't done yet. This whole time we've been talking about the prohibition of embarrassing somebody in public, but we haven't really talked at all about where that prohibition is. Where in the Torah do you find such a prohibition? How do you know that there's anything wrong with this? So the answer is, there's probably two places. This is something, for example, the Tashbetz in his commentary, one of the Rishonim, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos points out, but it's really really self-evident, that there seem to be two separate sources in the Chumash prohibiting embarrassing people. On the one hand, there is the subject that the Talmud was talking about in Bava Metzia. When the Talmud tells us this whole story about David and about Tamar, there was a reason it was on that subject. And that subject is the prohibition in the Torah known as Onah. Onah you could translate as oppression, maybe as afflicting somebody. And the prohibition of Onah, much of the discussion about this oppression is in the monetary realm. If I price gouge, if I charge a very high price, that's called Onah's Mammon, that's called oppressing somebody in the pocketbook, and that's prohibited by the Torah. And the context of that, so in the end of this discussion, the last Mishnah in that parak in Bava Metzia, the last Mishnah in that chapter tells us that just as there is Onah in the monetary realm, there is also Onah, there is also oppression in the emotional realm, in the verbal realm. It's known as Onah's Devar. that if I say things that are hurtful to people, that's a prohibition from the Torah called Anas Devar. And that includes a number of things. It includes far more than just embarrassing somebody. It includes anything that I could say that's going to cause anguish. The Mishnah gives a couple of examples. Some of these are famous. A famous example we're probably familiar with. If you go into a store and you ask how much something costs, and you're not really interested in buying it, you're just curious, and so you're going to get the guy all excited. Truth is, there are a number of interpretations in the Svarim as to what's wrong with that. Some suggest that it's because you're going to get the guy excited and you're not really interested in buying at all. Others say that it's not about that so much, but it's basically that you relate to this person as kind of your underling. That when you come in as a potential customer, so the idea is I'll buy this. If I buy this, I give you money. You give me the item. I benefit, you benefit. We're working together here. If I come in and I'm not interested in buying at all, I just want you to answer my questions for no reason, no benefit for you. So then I'm kind of looking down on you. There are various interpretations as to what exactly the problem is there, but that's something the Mishnah identifies as onas devarim, as hurting somebody through words. And there are other examples the Mishnah gives. If you go to somebody who has changed his way, somebody used to be a thief, and then he's repented, he's never stolen anything since, and you continuously say to this person, you remember when you used to be a thief? You remember your wild past? You remember what you used to do? How you used to bring such disgrace upon the community? So that's a terrible thing to do. That's causing somebody pain with what you're saying. That's called onas devarim. So it's clear that onas devarim includes certainly embarrassing people. Includes many other things, but it certainly also includes saying things that are embarrassing to people. But there's another prohibition as well. And this appears elsewhere in the Talmud. It appears in the Talmud in the tractate Erchin. And there, the Talmud is discussing a positive commandment that we have. We have a commandment in the Torah called Hocheach Tochiach Es HaMisach. The Torah says that if you find somebody who's on the wrong path, so you should try to set them straight. You should try to rebuke them and try to get them to do the right thing. And the end of the pasuk is V'lo Sisa Alav Chet. And you should not bear an iniquity, you should not bear a sin because of them. So what does that last phrase mean? So the Talmud, there are a couple of interpretations of that phrase, but the Talmud over there says, in the context of rebuking someone, it's a little bit of a complex topic, but in the context of that point, the Talmud says, Yachol afilu yishtane panav, maybe I should do this, maybe I should rebuke somebody, even if it will result in his face changing color, even if it means I will embarrass them, they'll turn red, maybe they'll turn red and then white, maybe I should still do it anyway. So says the Talmud, no. Look at the rest of the verse. You shall not get yourself in trouble because of it. You shall not bear iniquity because of it. So you have to know how to do things. You do it in a way that's not going to make your face change color. And if it does, you're in trouble. So that is an interesting point. The Torah often makes prohibitions in this way, that it tells you that even when you're justified, don't do it this way. All the more so when I'm not justified. For example, how do I know I'm not allowed to hit people? How do I know it's written from the Torah that you can't hit somebody? Because the Torah says that when you have a messenger of Beis Din that's giving somebody a punishment of lashes, so he's got to give exactly 40 lashes. And the Torah says 40, not more. You can't hit one more. And the point is that we understand from there that here you have somebody whose job it is to hit somebody, and yet if he goes one beyond, that's a prohibition. So certainly if I don't have any such justification, it's certainly prohibited. So too here, that even when I'm motivated by what may seem like a mitzvah, I'm motivated by setting somebody straight, fulfilling this commandment of Hocheach Tochiach Es HaMisacha, even so, I'm not allowed to go too far and embarrass them. So certainly if I'm not motivated by that, if I don't have this excuse, certainly there's a prohibition to humiliate people, to make somebody's face change color. So what emerges is that we really have two separate prohibitions, and they address two different halves of what's going on. That when you embarrass somebody, you're really doing two things. On the one hand, you're causing them inner pain, you're causing them emotional pain. And on the other hand, you're also lowering their dignity in the community. They're also taking away from their Tzelem Elokim, from their image in the image of God. You're making their face change color. You're making them have a lower status within the community around them. So this is covered by two separate prohibitions. On the one hand, onos devarim, causing somebody verbal oppression. And on the other hand, lo sisal of chait, not bearing iniquity by making somebody's face change color. So they're not always both relevant. If you embarrass somebody in public, So then you have both of these. Then you have not only the personal pain, but you also have the offense to their dignity. In private, so you may have saved them the face changing color, you may have saved them the indignity, but they're still going to feel bad, they're still going to have the verbal oppression, so that's something that we still have to be sensitive to. So it could be these poskim who distinguish, who say in private it's prohibited, and in public it's a disaster, so in private the issue is, anas devar, you violate this one prohibition of anas devar. But in public, you not only violate that, but you also violate this broader idea of striking at the image of God, at the Tzelem Elokim, and that's a separate prohibition, and perhaps that's what carries with it all of this potential severity that we've been talking about till now. So that doesn't mean to suggest that if it's just anas devarim by itself, that that's something that's a small issue. That's something that's very severe as well. The prohibition of anas devarim is in itself a prohibition. And in fact, there was one opinion in the Rishonim, the Mordechai. The Mordechai felt that this is something you should get lashes for. This is a prohibition in the Torah. If somebody does it, Beis Din should take him and strike him with lashes. And everyone else questioned this. Later, Sfarim asked about this because really we have a rule that not every prohibition in the Torah is eligible for such punishment. And one of the rules is that if it's a non-active prohibition, if it doesn't involve an action, lav sheim bo maisa, so normally there wouldn't be such a punishment. So that would seem to be the appropriate category here. So many question what the Mordechai was coming from, but that is one example of what you find. And you find that beyond that, that both the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch write that Beis Din has the right to impose whatever penalties they see fit in order to enforce this prohibition. I'm sorry. See, it's very clear in the Sfarim that you're not allowed to oppress children either. So teachers is a tricky point because when it's for the purpose of education, right, so the question is not the difference between an adult and a child. The question is to do with the function of authority. And so that there is, theoretically, some license for. But at the same time, it's something which I think, especially in a modern context, you have to be very, very careful about. Because practically speaking, you're not going to accomplish anything through humiliation. And if you don't accomplish anything, then nobody would allow it. So even though there is, in theory, some basis to permit, and it's not in my place to judge that, but as a matter of practical behavior, it's rarely ever going to be a good idea. Because it's going to... Because people who are humiliated tend to hate the people who humiliate them. And understandably, and tend to not be able to accept any positive message from that person. They force their authority for a minute, and you go to the other session, you'll see 10 years later, you'll be writing a blog about how all of Judaism is terrible because my Rebbe humiliated me when I was a kid. And as a long-term strategy, it's very, very, very ineffective. And even the poskim who would say that it's permissible would agree if it's not effective, then it's not permissible, and then you're left with a prohibition. So again, that's more a point of advice than a point of halacha, but I would be very, 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 very wary, to put it mildly. To put it mildly, I'd be extremely wary of ever using such a technique. It doesn't work in the real world. And the distinction, but then again, the point distinction is one of authority, not one of child versus adult, and it's clear that a child is also protected under the prohibition of Al-Tavarim, that the sources are very clear about. In fact, there's a famous story about the Stipler Gaon. You may have heard that Stipler Gaon once showed up at somebody's bar mitzvah in Bnei Brak, and he wasn't a friend of the family. I mean, they were very honored to have him there, but nobody knew what he was doing at the bar mitzvah. And so the Stipler said that 5 years earlier he had met an 8-year-old boy, and he had wrongfully assumed this boy was doing something wrong. It turned out he made a mistake. And he said something which he thought the boy may have felt was hurtful. So the disciple felt that he was in violation of anas devarim, and he wanted to ask him for forgiveness, but he felt that he couldn't fully forgive until he was an adult and empowered to forgive. So he had to wait until this child was bar mitzvah. So now he waited 5 years, child's bar mitzvah, he shows up at his bar mitzvah in order to ask him mechila for what he had said 5 years ago. So it's clear in the Svarim that the prohibition applies to children as well. And it's something that... we have to be very sensitive to. So just to really close it off, because we're just about out of time, I'll just mention actually one interesting example Because Rambam and Shulchan Aruch both do say that the Beis Din has the right to enforce whatever penalties they find necessary. So the Chasam Sofer actually has an interesting tshuva where somebody asked him about, I forgot, it was either the Chazin, somebody who was in a position in town, had done something, and they were asked how to deal with it, that there was another guy in town who was known for being very committed to the mitzvah of Mila, that he was a mo'el, and whenever anybody would have a baby boy, he would go to great lengths to be there to be able to be the mo'el. So this chazan or this shochet said to the guy, oh, I had a baby boy, Tuesday morning, why don't you come down to my farm, a 3-hour trip, and come and you'll be the mo'el. The guy travels all the way to the bris, and it turns out it's not a boy, it's a girl. It was a joke. So, isn't that funny? So, the guy didn't think it was funny at all. The guy felt very offended and felt very embarrassed. And they asked the Chasam Sofer what to do about this. Should this guy be fired? Should he be, how do you deal? A person who violates on the Ostavarim. So he doesn't recommend firing him, but he has a whole list there of what punishments should be imposed on such a person in recognition of the fact that on the Ostavarim is an actionable offense on some level. And it's interesting. One of the things he says there is that the guy should pay 10 gold coins. So where does that come from? So we have an idea. The Talmud says, the Sar Zehuvim, that if somebody steals a mitzvah from you, let's say I'm about to do the milah of my son, let's say the father has the first privilege, I'm about to do the milah of my son, and then somebody runs up and says, oh, eat the old baby, I'll do the milah, and he grabs a knife and he does the milah first. So he stole my mitzvah, he's got to pay me 10 gold coins. So, but here there wasn't any mitzvah to begin with. There was no baby boy. So apparently what the Chasam Sofer was figuring is that this guy undertook the trip because he thought he was going to get the Sar Zehuvim, and so therefore you have to pay him that as part of the whole package of compensation because of the Anas Devarim. So in any event, you find that the Poskim do have this attitude that Anas Devarim, even without the compromising the dignity, even without the Lo Sisa Lav Chet, is something that's very severe, something that the Beis Din has the right to enforce to whatever degree it finds necessary. And as is also found in the Sfarim, in a very ominous tone, God has many ways of dealing with those who ignore His directives. That's how, as this far and put it, it's a topic of great severity. So just as we're just about at time, I just want to quickly review what we spoke about. So we spoke about the fact that the Talmud tells us that David HaMelech was challenged by those who would try to embarrass him about his scandal, and he responded that it's better to commit adultery than to embarrass somebody in public because you lose a portion of the world to come. And the Talmud also tells a story about Tamar, who was apparently willing to give up her life rather than embarrass somebody in public. So that's the whole discussion. Is that really true? Do you have to give up your life rather than embarrass somebody? It seems to be that the issue is whether the comparison to murder is literal. The Talmud says that embarrassing somebody is like killing them. So do we believe that's actually the case, exactly like murder? Or is it just a homiletic way of making a point? And that would have apparently ramifications in this area. The question of, is it really something you give up your life for, which seems to be the view of Rabbeinu Yonah and Tosfos and perhaps a few others, even later generations. And on the other hand, the homiletic perspective would be that you don't actually give your life for it, and that's apparently the view of the Meiri and probably Rambam and many others. As we emphasized many times over, don't try this at home. And we mentioned the view of Rav Pinchas Levinson, which is that really maybe in theory it's true, in theory the humiliation could be so great, but since we could never know that in advance, we would never take a drastic step like saying give up your life rather than do this. And that could also affect the position of Rav Shlomo Kluger, who said that you don't have to save somebody else's life if it's going to humiliate you. Everyone disagreed with him about that. It's a very debated point, the halacha, but it seems to also revolve around the same logic. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is one of those who disagreed, but he also seemed to take a literal view when he discussed the question of why are we not violating Shabbos in order to save somebody from being embarrassed. Even if you would do it on a rabbinical level, on a biblical level, we don't do that, so why not? He's not sure. And again, it could be the same answer, that we don't know in advance that it's such a drastic step should be taken because there's such a spectrum of what could happen. We talked also about the question of whether or not somebody who embarrasses people, can you do Berachas Kohanim? Now, a great post can be talked about that. Nassim Gestetner and the Shevet Alevi thought that he still could, that it's not equal to murder, and there were others who took a little bit of a different view. And we talked about the question of whether this should be included as one of the 7 Noahide commandments, one of the 7 mitzvahs b'nei Noach. Is this applicable to all of humanity, or is this really just a Jewish commandment? And then we talked about the question of why is it that there's no portion of the world to come? It's a very severe punishment, and why should that be? So Rabbi Yonah was consistent with his view when he said it's actual murder, and therefore you get the punishment of a murderer, but even worse, because you're not going to repent, because you're not going to know it's bad. And the Rambam was consistent with his view that it's not equal murder, but it's an indication that you're a bad person, you're not such a high character, and therefore, as you put it, you're halachically a jerk, and no portion of the world to come. And then we talked about the third view, that there is a midah keneged midah that is proportionate, because the soul is a result of the tzelem elokim, and if you don't believe in dignity, you also don't believe in the tzelem elokim. So therefore, it's midah keneged midah. And then we talked about the question of malbim panei chaver barabim, reddening somebody's face in public. What does that phrase mean? First of all, why reddening, what not white? We talked about that a little bit. And then what about public? What does public mean, and do you need public? So we decided the public means 3, not 10, not more than that. And the 3 includes the 2 principles, so it means really 1 witness. And the question was, does it have to be in public? Even that witness, what about if it's in private? And we mentioned a debate about that, and we talked about the compromise view that if it's in private, it's prohibited, and in public, it's when it's terrible. And we talked about how that could be explained by the fact that we basically have 2 prohibitions here. On the one hand, the prohibition of onas dvarim, that if you say anything hurtful, that's always a prohibition. Many different examples of that prohibition, like when you ask somebody how much something costs and you're not intending to buy it, or when you remind somebody of their youthful indiscretions, and certainly embarrassing people is included in that. And there's another prohibition that even when you're rebuking somebody for positive purposes, still you can't do it in a way that's going to humiliate them, lo sisa lo chet. And apparently this talks to 2 different heads of the experience. You cause somebody pain, that's an onas dvarim, and you cause them a compromised dignity, that's lo sisa lo chet. And they don't always both apply, and therefore in private it's an onas dvarim, and in public it's where it has all those other strictures attached to it, because it's also lo sisa lo chet, which is not to say that in private only an onas dvarim is a small thing, it's a big thing. And we find that there was even an opinion you should get lashes for this, and that opinion is a little bit questionable based on the halacha, but it's still clear that the Beis Din has the right to do whatever it feels necessary in order to enforce this law. That's where the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch write it. And we mentioned the Tshuva L'Chasam Sofer, how he dealt with somebody who had played a cruel practical joke on somebody, and the various punishments he came up with, all reflecting this idea that Beis Din has to enforce this prohibition because it is a very severe prohibition, and we're sensitive to that both on private and public levels. Are we out of time?
We have
6 minutes.
Does anybody have any questions for Rav Feldman? If so, to the microphone, please.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay. Could you come to the microphone and ask it there?
Okay.
Why is embarrassing in public very bad?
That seems to be the crux of it all. Apparently what we're doing is we're striking at somebody's humanity. Somebody created the image of God. That means that they have a certain dignity. And if you say that that's not something that's important to you, then that's something that undermines the whole concept of being a human being. It's a very important question. Hi.
What is the relationship, between Lashon Hara and embarrassing?
There's a lot of overlapping territory.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Right. It's not the same thing. But there's a lot of overlapping territory. Lashon Hara is going to be when I talk about it to somebody else.
And
right, that person is not necessarily present. So clearly one can lead to the other, and then it's a beautiful cycle where they nourish each other. But the Lashon Hara certainly can lead to something damaging getting out, which can be embarrassing. And then when that happens, we'll talk about it, and there'll be more Lashon Hara. And so clearly there are a lot of overlapping territory, but they're not exactly the same. Lashon Hara is all talk about somebody not necessarily in the presence. They won't necessarily ever know about it, so they're not necessarily going to be embarrassed. And embarrassing doesn't necessarily have to involve my talking about them. It can happen in a number of ways. So there's certainly a lot of overlap, but they have distinct territories. Hi.
Could you speak to one point? When you talked about a person admonishing like a younger person, it occurred to me that there's actually very specific halakhas about a parent and a child, and up to a certain age you can admonish a child. And to me it seems like the age is kind of at the age at which the point kind of the child develops kind of like self-awareness, and it becomes important to him that he has like some kind of respect or whatever. And below that age, where respect isn't such a big issue to the child, you can admonish him and you can embarrass him and for purposes of, you know. So given we're kind of basing that on the level of understanding of the child or his self-image or whatever you want to call it, self-esteem, would that also affect, say, an adult who doesn't have, in particular, self-esteem?
That's hard to know. I think, in general, the prohibition is going to apply across the board either way. I think the source, if I'm not mistaken,
But a child can't embarrass a parent under any circumstance.
Correct, because there is on top of the prohibition of embarrassing, there's also the very severe issue both of kibud avim and mora avim, of reverence for parents, which both of which would add additional strictures.
It ties right back to resemblance to Hashem. Hashem created degrading us.
If you think that's what Kibbutz Avayim is about, right?
So it's still kind of the same idea.
Are we out of time? Is that what you're saying? Ah, okay.
No, it's 11:12.
Well, we have 11:12. So we have 3 minutes. We have a fast watch, maybe. But the source that I think that you're building on is the source that the Gemara says in Moed Kadin, that, again, without getting into the issues of hitting children, but there the Gemara says that certainly at above a certain age you shouldn't do it because it's going to just create them to lash back. Right, the Gemara is talking about something else, the lifnei iver, that you're causing them to hit back at you, and that's the bad advice. The Gemara says, so a big child you shouldn't do it to. So what does a big child mean? So some Rishonim say big doesn't mean 13, doesn't mean 20, doesn't mean 6 feet tall. It means that he's 6 or 7 years old. And as he has a certain amount of awareness, then that's when this kind of kicks in. So that is what I presume what you're talking about. I think that more comes l'chumra than l'kula. That basically means that from that age up, we would start being aware of this. But I wouldn't necessarily take away from anybody older than that. I think we have to assume that there is a lot more to sensitivity than we understand. And it's not necessarily a function of something that we can evaluate as what someone's awareness is or isn't.
But an effective parent is allowed to embarrass a younger child.
So in theory, and again, but I would highly, highly caution against you know a way somebody would do that. Again, if you want your children to learn anything, it's not a productive. Okay. So even when we talk about the prohibition of anas dvarim, it doesn't literally only mean things you do verbally. Really, things that cause emotional pain are all subsumed under anas dvarim. In fact, some discussion, why isn't monetary anah also a set of verbal anah? Because you also get annoyed by it. So the truth is, it's clear that even though we use the word dvarim, which would mean words, words mean meant to suggest emotions, meant to suggest things that you process in that way, and not necessarily words only. Okay.
On the issue of fishing tattoo,
yes.
So I'm a little confused here, but once the metaphor of embarrassment equals murder was suggested, it is further kishita tov for the Rambam to not go with the literal equation,
right?
Just given his general tendencies, right? But is he not characteristically inclined, l'chatzchila, to be metaphorical, in which case I would have thought he would argue embarrassment equals murder?
I don't know how this fits into a broader inclination of the Rambam. If he is inclined to be metaphorical, then I think all the more so he wouldn't necessarily take it literally as far as the halachic application is concerned. But I don't know how this fits into a... You know, I'm not trying to make all of the Rambam make sense in one theory here. Basically, just within this one local issue, we know that he doesn't seem to endorse giving up your life for it, so therefore he doesn't see it as actual equal to murder. So if so, so then when he explains other points, we see that it's consistent with that.
Within
this local issue. Right. I think we would need more absolute cases in order to get that point, probably more than we can cover in the last minute of the session. Thank you.
First off, I would like to give a tremendous yasher koch to Rav Feldman for an absolutely wonderful presentation.